in theaters tomorrow.
And you're listening to WMNF Sarasota, Tampa, WMNF Tampa, Sarasota, Clearwater, Community Conscious Radio. Hi, I'm Mary Glennie.
And I'm Arlene Engelhart, and you are listening to From a Woman's Point of View. You know, we'd like to suggest that if you have an unwanted car just creating stress, donate it to WMNF, and it will create more hours of your favorite programs. Call 1-888-966-3885 or visit WMNF.org to schedule your free and convenient pickup today or at your convenience.
You know,
I just noticed that we had gotten a Facebook, I don't know if you'd say message, but whatever, from Dr. Simmons.
And she posted. Oh, I've got to have her back again.
Yes, but she had posted that a company has now designed a gun that folds up to look like a cell phone.
Yes, well, I've definitely got to have Dr. Gwendolyn Simmons back. But yeah, 3D printing. You know, they're working out the bugs for assembling your own home, your own plastic gun. But I'm hoping, actually, because I was listening to Amy Goodman, Democracy Now!, in their wonderful interview of Arundhati Roy. And, you know, I think it takes a great writer and a thinker of her ability to actually bring some sense to these times, although actually we've kind of lived through this in the past, maybe not us literally, but our people, our foremothers, our forefathers did. And we've been in feudal systems in and out for thousands of years. And I think they're totally right in the way our corporate, the way our economic system is now on the international level. That essentially, as Maud Barlow in Canada a long, long time ago said, that actually there are no more common grounds. And that actually common grounds are some of the most important aspects of the human race. Being able to share the land they needed to grow the crops or the animals could feed, etc. And these are very, very difficult times. And so that's why I'm really excited with the two guests we're going to be having very, very shortly, Julie Kohler and Felicia Wong. And that actually, they've written, a pretty amazing, or not amazing, I think a very interesting article in The Nation, why 2018 might not be the year of the woman. But I think also they bring to this article a background that Julie Kohler is actually a VP of Strategy and Planning with Democracy Alliance, and that Felicia Wong is the CEO of the Roosevelt Institute. Yes, the continuation of what would Franklin and Eleanor be thinking and trying to do now. And I think it is in kind of those times. And so, as I say, very shortly, we will be reaching them by phone and talking to them. At least I hope so. Felicia Wong is out in an area that she said they don't always get real great reception, but she said it'd be very simple. if the operator or if you get a message cannot be reached, you'll realize that we're no longer in service for right now. But anyway, with that in mind, I'm really excited. And so let's put this music on because I think that it's kind of like, you know, the native, one of the native legends of the Spider Woman, whipping, you know, spinning the web of the world. And it's all connected. And unfortunately, power and economics have connected, I think, in a particularly awful way, really. So anyway, let's put this on. And then we'll come back with Julie Kohler and Felicia Wong.
Skill without a long, don't count.
to pod this down because we are having a lot of trouble reaching Dr. Felicia Wong. But I have sent Arlene out, and she's going to try and work on to see if she can get a better line or a better number, actually. But with us on the phone, I am really excited because we have Julie Kohler, Dr. Julie Kohler, actually. She has a PhD from the University of Minnesota, and she is with Democracy Alliance, and that's a pretty extraordinary organization, which I'm going to have her tell us about. And she is a VP for Strategy and Planning of the Democracy Alliance. And so anyway, Julie Kohler, welcome so much to the show.
Thank you. It's great to be with you.
Well, I was drawn to the article that you and your colleague Felicia Wong wrote in The Nation, Why 2018 Might Not Be the Year of the Woman. And, you know, with everything that's happening right now, I hope it's the year of the woman, but I'm hoping it's the year kind of of American reckoning, if you will. And so before we get into your article, because I think it really relates, Democracy Alliance, tell us about your organization.
Sure. The Democracy Alliance is a community of donors, individual donors and institutional donors like foundations and labor unions who have really come together to advance a progressive vision of America. And we invest, our donors invest collectively in many of the organizations that are moving this nation in a more progressive direction.
And tell me, do you see on, you know, because obviously all eyes are focused on 2018. And so, do you see, actually, the kind of political organization, particularly in the Democratic Party, that that you might hope to see? Or I'm not saying just the Democrats, but particularly, are you seeing the kind of organizations that really seem to be the response to this threat?
Right. Well, that was the point of caution that Felicia Wong and I wanted to highlight in writing this article. The bottom line is there is a lot to be excited about as we head into the 2018 midterm elections. We are seeing, you know, just incredible levels of activism really led by women, everything from the women's marches to the Me Too movement to the advocacy around the Affordable Care Act, even longstanding social justice movements like Black Lives Matter that have really been led by women. And now we're beginning to see that energy and activism become electrolyzed. So record-breaking numbers of women have declared that they're running for office this cycle. Emily's List has had just, you know, they've been besieged by calls. 36,000 women have reached out to them saying that they're interested in running for office or working for political campaigns. That's a rate of nearly 40 times what they saw last cycle. So there's real potential in this moment, but an organic wave of enthusiasm does not comprise or constitute a political strategy. And so the point of caution that Felicia and I wanted to highlight was that, you know, there's a reason that conservatives are so politically dominant. It's because for cycles, they have really invested in building a strong bench of political talent. And what we wanted to call progressive donors and progressive activists on, is that the time has come for us to build something comparable and to really invest at the level that conservatives have been doing for decades.
Well, you know, I have read pretty extensively Jane Mayer, some of her wonderful work. I've also read Democracy and Change and some other, you know, materials that really have pointed out this 30, 40-year effort, particularly with some funding at the Koch brothers, et cetera, that there is an extensive internet, you might say, just interconnected groups at just about every level. And frankly, they have pretty much, in my opinion, taken over the Republican Party. And it's really, to me, almost horrifying to the degree. And, you know, watching right now and so many of the federal judges being appointed, and we realize the organization it took to get those, that line, that channel. And, you know, I remember actually, you know, in college that they would particularly come to colleges in the Midwest, Notre Dame, University of Illinois, schools like that. And they would be recruiting, you know, these more conservative bent young college students even then. And so there's almost a leadership training, and I think it's called the Leadership Institute, isn't it?
That's right. So I'm based in Washington, D.C., and right across the river in Arlington, Virginia, there is a $20 million, you know, or an organization with a $20 million annual budget called the Leadership Institute that does exactly what you're talking about. They go around to college campuses and they identify the best and the brightest, you know, all these bright, passionate, young, conservative people, and they bring them to Washington and they train them not only to be potential candidates and, you know, political operatives, but to really, you know, fill out a variety of roles within the conservative movement. And not only do they invest in young people, but they provide whole, you know, support throughout folks' political careers at every stages. They provide fellowships and mentoring and job placement advice, etc. And progressives just simply have not built that level of scale and that centralized kind of leadership development institute that conservatives long ago recognized was necessary.
Yeah, and I'm thinking of all the organizations that I've been in, et cetera, and practically all of them, always money was a factor. You always, so much always had to go into raising money, you know, et cetera, and then limiting kind of what you can do. And that just simply isn't a problem. And, you know, doing essentially the women's show for years, you see the kind of money that has been in the battle for against women's reproductive rights and the battles against violence against women, so many areas. And that's a huge factor. If you can put all of your energy and time into, you know, your policies or your issues and getting out, but instead of having to constantly worry about money.
Yeah, absolutely. And so, you know, of course, there's going to always be an imbalance of money. I mean, this is just true across the board. Conservatives spend more at kind of in every aspect of politics than do progressives. But I think that we can also begin to spend more strategically. You know, there is $6.5 billion spent on federal elections in this country. Building a really comprehensive progressive talent system would cost in the ballpark of about $20 million annually. And so if we could, you know, shift resources, really think more strategically about building that bench of progressive political talent, I think it would reap rewards that would go long past 2018 and really, you know, create an enduring legacy.
But I'm going to play devil's advocate here. I'm kind of looking at what's happened to the Republican Party, and I am not so sure that actually what has resulted from this kind of organization, you might say, at the bottom, but from a man that really, David Koch, who really feels that he was, you know, enlightened on the mountaintop, if you will, even though I find his vision pretty limited. And so you have, frankly, in my opinion, a party and issues that are so narrow. And not only that, to me, they don't have the kind of rapport with their communities, with the people that they really need. And so I'm not saying that the democratic system of kind of this big tent that's utterly unorganized, with maybe not as much money, but not even spending it wisely, I'm not so sure that what's happened there is the best result.
Right. Well, I think we want to be cautious, and I think you're making exactly the right point. We don't want to just simply replicate what conservatives have built. And moreover, I think there's a real opportunity right now to flip what we've traditionally looked at as, or how we've defined viable candidates and viable political campaigns. It's not simply, you know, kind of who has the greatest fundraising potential or who has raised the most money. If we can put together systems where people-powered campaigns are winning, then that really flips the equation entirely. And when Felicia and I were writing this article for The Nation, we identified some political operatives that are doing just that. So Jessica Byrd, for example, she runs a political consulting firm called 3 Point Strategies, and she works exclusively with Black women candidates. And when she goes in to kind of vet the potential candidates that she's working with, she has simply stopped asking them, you know, how much money have you raised? What's your fundraising base? You know, who is in the political establishment is recruiting you to run? And what she asks them is, do you have an engaged base of folks that are going to work as a field operation for you? And, in you know, she worked with 5 Black women candidates in 2017 that were running for mayor. 3 of them won, and 1 lost by 800 votes. if we can win with different types of campaigns, everything changes. I mean, the whole definition of what constitutes or comprises a viable political candidate changes.
Yeah, and I'm pretty excited, actually, with your article. Again, right now we're talking to Julie Kohler. Arlene is still trying very much, she and DT, to get in touch with Felisa Wong. But anyway, because to me, you mentioned her, but also in California, there is the nurse. And I was so impressed because she really watched the dearth of healthcare in her community. And so she decided that she, after 40 years in the nursing profession, she was going to do something about this. And so, yes, she had organization. She worked with some organizations there, but that this was totally on the ground. Her contacting literally everybody in her district, so to speak. And it's, to me, it's that kind of contact. And I think that the emphasis, frankly, in politics, both Republican and Democrat, of just money, and that money has to determine it, and that money, that if your viability as a candidate is too often determined by how much money you can show that you can raise. To me, that has to change.
Yeah, absolutely. And I agree. Marge Doyle, who is the candidate we spoke with, she's running for Congress in California's 8th District, which is the most rural district. It's the largest, most rural district in the state. It's actually where Felisa is right now. She's teaching at Deep Springs College, and it is so rural that, in fact, I think it's probably causing our connectivity problems today. But Marge was a really inspiring candidate and someone that we were very interested to talk to because she's running one of these people-powered hyper-local campaigns. She's staying true to progressive ideals, but she's really addressing community concerns. I mean, she is a nurse. She has 40 years of experience working on healthcare issues. She worked as an elected official on a healthcare district board to save the county's one remaining rural hospital. And she's putting together a thoughtful, kind of pragmatic campaign that's really based on assisting the realities of her community members and figuring out solutions that work. And that is reaping success. I mean, she has actually outraised the Republican incumbent the last two quarters. So it's not just that, you know, we shouldn't be kind of finding candidates to follow dollars, but dollars can sometimes follow candidates, the right kind of candidates. And I think that's what we're seeing with, you know, Marge Doyle in California and numbers of women across the country.
Well, and again, we're talking to Julie Kohler, and she and her colleague, Felisa Wong, have written, I think, a very interesting article, Why 2018 Might Not Be the Year, excuse me, of the Woman. And I'm going to go particularly back to the woman, because I think in so many ways that you know, with the women's march right away, and also with a kind of flagrant sexual predator, if you will, in the White House right now, and then way too many on his staff, that it's a particularly challenge to women. And I think that I think it's fabulous that so many are running, you know, 300 for Congress alone, et cetera, and some of the statistics you gave. I think it puts an awful lot of pressure on them, particularly in light of an election where, you know, it was perhaps. And I have to ask you about that. I mean, are you encouraged that, particularly, I think, the terrific personal beating, I mean, not physically, but emotionally in every way, that Hillary Clinton took in this last election, which was not like any election I've ever seen before, that I'm very pleased that women, rather than thinking, wow, I'm not going to run for office, they've done just the opposite.
Yeah, no, I think we have to credit women for refusing to let that, you know, deter them from stepping into the public sphere. So we are at a really encouraging moment, but it is not sufficient. You know, I mean, we saw this wave of activism. I mean, everyone talks about how in 1992 we had the Year of the Woman, and we did see some real gains in terms of women's representation, certainly in Congress and other levels of government. But the needle has not moved far enough in 25 years. And if we are simply waiting for things to get bad enough every 25 years, that women's kind of mass outrage will, you know, kind of inspire another group of women to say enough is enough, that is not a really thoughtful political strategy. We need to be recruiting and investing and building the kind of talent system so that every year is the year of the woman. I mean, women are still comprising about 20% of Congress. The rates of governors is 8%. We are nowhere near gender parity. And just in terms of political power, conservatives are still in vast majorities, not only controlling the White House and Congress, but, you know, having trifectas in 33 states as opposed to Democrats 8. So we have a lot of work to do to really rebuild, and thinking about the people as part of that equation, that needs to really be put at the forefront.
And, you know, Julie Kohler, you mentioned actually 25 years ago, and that was after Anita Hill. And I think it really was kind of illustrative that the few women that were in Congress then, they got what was happening to Anita Hill, and they were so upset, and they didn't feel she was being given a fair shake at all. And so they walked out, you know, and here we come forward 25 years, and we have, you know, unfortunately, a little too similar situation, if you will, and then we've had the Me Too bang. And I think we're at such a critical juncture of how do we translate, you know, what we know is happening and we know is really so oppressive and holding women back, to not just to be a moment that bursts, so to speak, but to actually get the kind of programs where we follow through and we expose the kind of not just harassment, but the sexism that is holding women back in their careers. And, you know, next week, actually, I'm going to have Jennifer Palmieri, who was, you know, was one of the main campaign advisors to Hillary Clinton. She was a part of President Obama's administration. And I think she's written just a really, I don't know if you've read it, her great little book. And she's written it to the future woman who is going to be president someday. And I think she really brought out some points that are so interesting. And I think for women now, and she said one of the biggest mistakes they made is that actually they didn't allow Hillary to be a woman, if you will. That she and her role, and practically every woman in power, has been forced to play the men's game, so to speak. But always at a liability, that she's always under examination, that pretty much no matter how she responds to a situation, she's not given the benefit of the doubt. And I think we're kind of there now, because that I think that, you know, that if women don't win these offices, that you hope that they say, well, hey, you know, that's all right, I've learned a lot, I'm going to run again. But you don't want people saying, well, what could you expect, you know, that she was not a good candidate and all this kind of stuff, that frankly kind of echo what Hillary Clinton was charged with.
Right. I mean, you know, we are never going to, you know, defeat kind of sexism and misogyny playing a role in electoral politics altogether. You know, women candidates, it's going to be a dynamic for women candidates. However, with the kind of support that we can provide women candidates, we can not only help numbers of women win this cycle, but we can have them, we can capture all that talent so that they can go ahead and run again, or that they can use their talent for other important ways in the political sphere. And so that's the concern. If we don't have this comprehensive system of cultivating and nurturing progressive talent, all of this could dissipate very quickly, and we want it to be sustained. We want to think of the ways that we can help make sure that it's not lost, that we're not just a blip, that people don't remember, oh, 2018 is this year of this influx of women candidates, but that we're really beginning to turn the tide, both on the composition of political power in this country and rates of gender representation at every level of elected office.
Well, I am glad to say, Julie, that I think they have finally managed to reach Felicia. And so, Felicia, can you hear us?
Yes, I can. Good morning, Mary.
Good morning.
Well, Julie has been performing nobly. And DT, thank you so much. You have no idea. We practically had to send up smoke signals to reach you, Felicia Wong. Where are you that this has been so difficult? I'm curious.
Oh, well, yes, I'm teaching at Deep Springs College, which is a small college in far eastern California, sort of on the Nevada border. And so there, it is definitely isolated.
Well, listen, you're going to have a lot of people trying to find it, because I think in our world right now, people might like to find an area that is so hard to get through. But Dr. Wong, actually, and got her PhD at University of Cal Berkeley. We're going to jump forward because you're the CEO of the Roosevelt Institute, and Eleanor Roosevelt, Pickley, and Franklin are kind of heroes of mine in the sense of all they did for people. And so I'm really fascinated, and I spend a lot of time at both of your websites, Democracy Alliance and also the Roosevelt Institute. And Felicia, if you will, that I think the kind of economic policies that people need to understand and change, to me, in order to make this a viable a democratic country, I think that we've got real challenges, don't you? And part of it is that people really, I don't think, quite understand it.
Yes, I do think we have real challenges. I think those challenges are eminently solvable. And I do think, I think there's a difference between people not understanding the expert macroeconomics, really not understanding exactly how the interest rate and the unemployment rate and all those things, affect their daily lives. I think that is true, but I also think that voters, women in particular, I might venture, but voters actually understand the real life problems, you know, the kind of problems that hit every family at the kitchen table. Problems of jobs, problems of wages, problems of, you know, transportation, it's hard to get to your job, problems of education, and all those things are actually wrapped up in the economy that as it affects all of us. And I'll further say that the candidates whom Julie and I have interviewed and who are really breaking out and are most successful, they are able to connect how people feel about healthcare access or about, you know, their ability to find a job that can pay the rent. Those candidates are able to really connect economic issues to people's political action or political engagement. So I do think that the economy is a very real set of issues, but great candidates are able to make that plain for folks.
Well, that's why I think it's so important. And in your article, that you really emphasize that in a way that the Democratic establishment, if you will, has to really have a new perspective in choosing candidates. That, you know, you can't just kind of try and be moderate in the middle and kind of placate this, but that actually people on the ground, like the teacher strikes, which are so great, you know, happening in West Virginia and all over, that these teachers who are mainly women really get it, that they realize there has to be more revenue coming in for the schools, for the needs of the people. It's not just about their salaries and their benefits. And this is huge. And if these kind of candidates then decide, you know, that, hey, I'm going to run for office because I see this, you know, I see what's happening in my school, or I see what's happening, so many nurses, the same thing in their hospitals, that if they're just given a chance, this will really, I think, relate to people because it is the lives we're all leading. Felicia or Julie?
Yeah, no, I would agree with you, Mary. I think this is the time for candidates to be bold. And we're seeing that when people are running on bold issues and really speaking to people in ways that resonate with their lived experiences, they're winning. So, you know, for a long time, I think the prevailing wisdom has been that Democrats need to be a little tepid around certain issues, or we shouldn't talk about taxes, we shouldn't talk about, you know, kind of all of these, you know, the third rail, supposedly, of American politics. And I think we're in a time when that has fundamentally changed. People are looking for bold action. They're looking for people that seem authentic, that understand what they're experiencing in their communities. And so whether it's the economic issues that Felicia just talked about or other issues, I mean, some of the issues that, again, Jessica Byrd talked about that are really, you know, at the forefront for many of the candidates that she's working with, whether it's the effects of police violence in the communities, you know, whatever it might be, you know, the challenges that families face in finding childcare or in caring for elderly parents at the end of their lives. These are issues that people understand and they want candidates to address.
Yeah, and yet we're following Nancy Pelosi saying, no, don't mention impeachment. It's a good thing that she, I think, is saying that you have to have your own policies and issues, which you really stand by. But then you also have the tape or the recording of Cindy Hoyer and telling the situation in California, this is how it really is, to Tillerman. And so you kind of wonder if the establishment gets it.
Well, I think increasingly, the establishment will get it again by seeing different types of folks win. And so I think it is really beholden upon all of us to continue that energy and that grassroots momentum. And again, to kind of change the behavior of progressive donors and progressive operatives to invest in the kind of supports so that these candidates are poised to win and are poised to prevail, not just this cycle, but over the long term.
And Felicia, I'm going to go back to you a minute, particularly at the Roosevelt Institute, just so many wonderful economic analysis they have on your website. And I think it's really important because, you know, there's the economy and there's the economy. There's the economy if you're in the uber wealthy, that you're doing very well. You've probably never done better. And the Republicans are so happy about their tax cuts that they passed that they can't understand why they aren't getting more resonance. And yet the people at the level, so to speak, of where most of the people are, really, do you think they've really seen such an improved economy? Do you really think that they have the kind of jobs with the kind of futures? And to me, again, that if you're not allowed to really call a spade, and say, hey, has this really recovered? Recovered for whom? And to me, I think that requires a lot of courage. And so don't you think that if women or whatever candidates, if they have the guts to say this, to challenge this, because I happen to think the economy has not recovered for the vast majority of people, and we need some serious changes if it's going to. Don't you think that could be a factor if they're allowed to talk about those issues? Felicia or Julie, I don't
know. Felicia may be having some ongoing technical issues.
We probably lost her again. Okay.
We may have lost her again.
Okay.
But I'll speak for her on this one and recognizing that I'm not the leader of the economic policy think tank that Felicia is. But absolutely. I mean, I think we're beginning to see different types of economic agendas taking shape in communities all over this country, where we're really putting the experiences of community members and family members at the forefront. And so, you know, there are more and more campaigns around kind of the, you know, family economic issues around paid sick leave and access to childcare, high quality childcare, and again, you know, caring for elderly parents, and all of these sort of caring issues that are real economic issues that have just been completely ignored by a mostly male political establishment for many decades. And I think the time is long overdue for these to be at the forefront, and I think that they can really help promote a political realignment, because everyone can see those issues in the way that they play out in their own lives.
Well, Julie Kohler, you have really been a soldier.
and Mary and Julie, I'm so sorry, but I am back.
Great. You should answer that.
Desert winds, what can I say?
Well,
I just want to echo everything that Julie said and just add one quick thing, which is that, you know, we do see very big economic ideas on the table and gaining a lot of traction, including, I might add, a federal jobs guarantee. Which I'm happy to talk more about, but really is also an issue for both women and men.
Well, Felicia and Julie, I'm looking at the time, and it's pretty much run out. And Felicia, well, I'll have to get a hold of you. Maybe if you're back out of that area, we'll be able to talk to you, because I do want to talk about some of those economic policies, which I think are so important. But Julie Kohler, Felicia Wong, thank you so much. Number one, for the article in The Nation, and I think people will really get a lot out of reading it, and then going from there, maybe going to your websites, Democracy Alliance and the Roosevelt Institute. Just some very, very worthwhile writing, thinking, and thank you so much for all the time you've given us today.
Thank you, Mary.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. Well, that was an adventure. You and DT learned probably more about phones online than you ever wanted to know. But anyway, I think they were really quite interested, and I knew that Julie was, you know, quite knowledgeable.
Yeah, I'm sorry we lost or couldn't get through to Felicia. It was really strange.
No, she
finally had her call in.
Oh, you got her enough that she could. Oh, is that how it happened?
I could get her on my cell phone.
Oh, just not in our
phones. Just not on our phones.
Okay. Well, whatever works. So anyway, well, okay. So I'm going to put this music back on. And then very sweetly, Stephanie Kite, the new CEO of the Planned Parenthood of Central and Southwest Florida, stopped by the station yesterday, and we were able to talk to her. And I think you'll be interested to see what Planned Parenthood has in its agenda. So let me put this music on, and you are listening to WMNF Tampa, Sarasota, Clearwater Community Conscious Radio. Plod this down, and now we're going to listen to Stephanie Kite. Excuse me. Well, I am so happy to welcome to the show Stephanie Kite, and she is the new CEO of Planned Parenthood of Central Southwest Florida, and she's replacing Barbara Dravecki. So, Stephanie Kite, welcome so much to the show.
Well, thank you so much, Mary. I'm delighted to be here and very excited to be in Florida and be leading this amazing organization.
Well, Barbara really, I thought, really made a very strong organization, frankly, against pretty high odds. Florida is not the easiest state, I think, for Planned Parenthood. And so, now, you led a very large organization in Ohio before.
That's right. I was CEO of Planned Parenthood in Ohio. I also spent some time with Planned Parenthood in California and in Washington, D.C. So I'm here to tell you that it's tough for women all over this country right now and tough for our reproductive rights, both politically and really hard on abortion rights in America today.
It really is. And so tell me, what do you consider some of the very biggest challenges right now? Because I've thought these last few years have just been unbelievable. And I'm so proud that Planned Parenthood is still in there fighting, but I'm very worried.
Well, we're standing strong because millions and millions of people across America are standing with Planned Parenthood and the patients we serve every day. And our motto, care no matter what, is truly what guides us every day. We care no matter what. And in these really difficult times, and they're difficult at the state level, and they're difficult at the federal level. So we have states like Ohio, where I most recently came from, and Florida, where they're passing laws that make accessing reproductive health care more difficult for women, and sometimes even more dangerous. And now we're looking at a Trump-Pence administration who is systematically diminishing the role of women's health in the through policy and rulemaking across the federal government. And it is very dangerous time for women. We're looking at teen pregnancy prevention programs that are having rules written where they can only teach abstinence and where organizations that have a faith bias get the money before medically accurate information. So everywhere you turn right now in our governments, they are diminishing women's health care as an important part of our life and writing rules to make sure that their perspective on sex and sexuality is what is taught to young people across this country.
Yet this Planned Parenthood services more women, we're talking millions, and in fact, I thought it was interesting in the lobby that invariably, whenever you mention Planned Parenthood, either that woman or her daughter or someone else, her sister, has used Planned Parenthood at some point in her career. And, you know, it gets to be expected because for an awful lot of women, their primary physician really is their OB-GYN. And so Planned Parenthood, of course, would serve that role. And I think the most tragic thing is that there's so much focus is on abortion, yet all the other medical services you do, particularly to poor, disadvantaged, college kids, et cetera, is absolutely essential to their health.
Well, that's right. And young women across America know exactly what Planned Parenthood provides for their health care, whether it's contraceptive services, breast cancer or cervical cancer screenings. And for those women who need it, we do provide abortion care. Unfortunately, in this country, abortion care has become politicized and a political weapon to galvanize people and confuse them. And that's really unfortunate because it is a medical procedure that some women need in their life, and we're proud providers of that. But as you say, Mary, we provide a whole range of reproductive health services. And in fact, 1 in 5 women in America have used Planned Parenthood for their health care at some point in their life. 1 in 5. I'm not sure 1 in 5 of us has shopped at Target, but we've sure as heck been to a Planned Parenthood, not only because we're accessible and affordable, but also because of the quality and how we talk to women about their health care, talking to them honestly and respectfully, which you don't always get from all the medical professionals in the world.
You know, it's interesting because I've done this show for many years, and we used to have a lot of musicians come in, and so often we'd be covering something about Planned Parenthood or contraception or abortion or whatever, and I thought it was really interesting because so many of the musicians, they would tell us, you know, that they absolutely use Planned Parenthood and they totally believe them, and now they were, many of them were quite successful, and so they make it sure to put their money where their mouth is to really support it, and Planned Parenthood is over 100 years
101, we're very proud to be. And, you know, the great thing about being 101 is you have an excellent perspective on life, right? And the amazing thing is what we're doing today in terms of providing honest, accurate information about women's bodies and how reproduction works is exactly what Margaret Sanger was doing 101 years ago when women weren't allowed to use birth control and they needed to control their and plan their families. And that's really what the whole organization was started around, is getting women honest information about how to plan their families. It's still what we do every day all across this country.
And it's still being challenged.
Well, right. And so I think at the heart of all of that is the whole challenge of women's role in society. And we're certainly seeing that served up on a carving platter these days, aren't we, in terms of what the role women should play. And I'm certainly excited to be watching what's happening across the country after this election, where we're seeing women rise up with, you know, Me Too and Time's Up and all the places we're finally finding the courage to call out the men who have so long held us down and the structures that have held us down and not allowed us to be successful. But we know that if a woman can't manage her fertility, plan her family, that her success is often hindered. And so, you know, that's at the heart of what we do every day. And we have a lot of energy and every expectation that we'll be doing it for another 100 years.
And again, we're talking to Stephanie Kite, and she is the new CEO of Planned Parenthood of Central Southwest Florida. And I'm very impressed so far, because you've not been on the job very long in February, but you have had several functions with Tamara Burke, and she is really one of the founders of Me Too. And I think that's great, because tell me, Stephanie, because you've been involved with Planned Parenthood for a long time, and with this time right now with Me Too, and you know all the challenges, but also I think it's really important that women really connect so many different organizations, because it's frankly not enough just to expose things. We really have to have some plans and proposals going forward to use this moment rather than lose it.
That's right. Women need to stand up, and young women across the country are standing up, and we need to lift ourselves up and our voices up and actually demand the policies support our lives and not be policies that are written based on somebody's, you know, particularly some man's perspective on how we should be living our lives. And it's really exciting to see the young women rising up. And what they know is it's not just their reproductive rights that they need to fight for, but they need to fight for their school safety, and they're fighting for immigrant rights, and they're fighting for racial equity and gender equity and LGBTQ issues and all of these issues that intersect in the lives of our young people. And as women who've been in this movement a really long time, like you and I have, we need to make sure that we're using our power and our privilege and of our lives to make space for these young women and rise up with them to make sure our power is seen in this community.
Yeah, just last week, you know, I had a woman, Jane McAlevey, talking about the teacher strikes. Mm. And she's also covered the nurses' strikes a lot. And these are primarily women. And a lot of people didn't really understand understand the media didn't cover it well in West Virginia and other areas, it's not just about pay and benefits. It's much more so about allocation of resources, you know, really having the materials they need and not, so to speak, trying to gut public schools. And to me, that's what this is really about. It is about women, really, and that intersectionality, and that the time is both, I think, in some ways, never been much more threatening. You know, I'm looking at some of the abortion laws that are being passed right now, or trying to be passed in states where it's going to be across the board illegal. And I'm not saying that the most important issue to a woman is abortion, but that is, you know, whoever, God or whoever you want to say, you know, women do have this power of birth, of life. And I, as far as I'm concerned, if you do not trust women, if you do not see women as the moral equivalency that are able to decide what to do in this most important time, then women are always going to be second rate.
That's right. You know, women have abortion for lots of different reasons, but it's not our place to judge. We don't know her circumstances. We don't walk in her shoes. That decision is best left to a woman, her family, her faith, in consultation with her physician. That's actually what America believes, and that's what we should support as policy. I agree with you. We need to trust women and their families and the physicians in this world to make the right decision about a pregnancy outcome. And it is time for women to stand up and say enough. Like, we have, this is the line in the sand. For years we've been saying, well, they won't go that far and they won't go that far, but we're actually seeing policies that are beginning to encroach upon our ability to take birth control or access all forms of birth control we want. Now we have a law that says your boss can decide if you can have birth control as part of your health insurance. We should be appalled as a country that we allowed that to stand. And if women don't stand up right now in this moment and say enough, and vote on these issues to make sure we have the right kind of policymakers in office, then we will continue to lose significant ground.
And tell me, how do you feel about the ERA?
I think that it's long overdue, and I was, you know, I lived in the era where I saw that come and go, to much to my heartbreak, and I actually think, in some sense, it's sad that we still have to have an ERA, because I think many of us back then thought we were well on our way to having our equal rights without it having to be an amendment. But in fact, this last year has taught us that it is very easy for us to slide backwards in our rights, and so again, to stand up for that and say we just cannot go back.
Well, you know, Stephanie Kite, I'm really impressed because, as far as I'm concerned, you're really reaching out because you have a very broad area here, you know, and just to be here right in the radio station, I'm really thrilled. And tell me, is that part, or are you just trying to meet all the people and the different, you know, groups you're going to be working with? Or give us an idea of how you want to be the CEO.
Well, every single person in our area is important to me, right? Every potential patient, every current patient, every supporter, every activist. There's millions of us in the territory we serve between Orlando and Tampa down to Naples. And it's really important that we connect at this time. So I am actually on a pretty major road trip to meet people and connect with them, and including the 170 staff members who get up every day with one thought in mind, which is, how do I care for the next young person walking through our doors? Those are the real heroes that are out there doing the work and making sure young people are educated and cared for with deep compassion and real honesty. And so to be part of that staff team and to be part of a community of activists and supporters is truly one of the most uplifting things you could possibly do. And it's just an incredible privilege to be able to do this work in this area.
And also at the time that Cecile Richards has decided that it's time for her to do something else. And, you know, she did such a fabulous job. But I just read an editorial she wrote, and she said she's not in the least bit worried about Planned Parenthood. She said it's been around for a long time. It's going to stay around. And she said exactly the same thing you did. It's because the people you serve are the most important thing.
That's right. We always center our patients in our day, in our month, in our life. And so it keeps it easier when there's chaos all around you to remember that, to just to look into the eyes of a frightened 17-year-old and say, how can I help you? And know that we've got staff and people there to care for that person. That's really what matters every day to us.
And so anybody listening, how can they find out more about Planned Parenthood?
Well, we'd love to have you take a look at our website, myplannedparenthood.org, and you can find ways there to get involved with us. Obviously, we always need donations. The healthcare we deliver is underwritten by the donations you give to us every day. So the funds, the support, and then I would also encourage everyone to write to every single elected official they know of and talk about how important this issue is to you, that it you expect them to take care of women and young people and to pass laws that support us, not put us back.
Well, I'll certainly be in contact with your organization in the future, but I really want to thank you for stopping by the station. I wanted to meet you because Barbara was fabulous, Rebecca, and I can see you're going to be fabulous too. So thanks so much, and welcome to Florida.
Thank you. I'm very excited to be here, and we'll talk more in the future.
Okay, well, thank you so much. Stephanie White, she is the new CEO of Planned Parenthood for Central and Southwest Florida. And so let's hear this little announcement, and then we will continue.
Hi, this is Desiree Lynn with a WMNF community announcement. Tampa Food Not Bombs is a solidarity-based resource for the houseless community, sharing meals twice weekly in Lakes Gaslight Park downtown. Every meal we serve is a demonstration against America's massive food waste and lacking social services, while critical resources are diverted to militarism and war. We serve only vegan and vegetarian meals, and our shares take place Tuesday mornings at 8 a.m. and Saturdays at 4 p.m. You can check us out online at Facebook at Tampa Food Not Bombs.
And indeed, another important service of WMNF. But it's been quite a show today. These desert winds, that's kind of interesting, Felicia Wong. But if you really want some very interesting economic analysis, go to Roosevelt Institute's website, and I think you'll get some very interesting reading. Institute for Policy Studies also has some terrific one. But I think we really need to get far more knowledgeable about economics and also express our opinions. So, Arlene, do you have any announcements?
No, just want to encourage people to keep their dials tuned to WMNF. Lots of good programming all day long, both public affairs and music. And coming up in the next hour is Radioactivity. And from a little bit that I've seen here, it looks to me like there may be something about oil. I could be wrong, but I'm guessing.
Oh, fossil fuels. Right. Okay, well, you have been listening to WMNF Tampa, Sarasota, Clearwater, Community Conscious Radio, and again, I still kind of the whole show with everything that was going on, I was thinking about Erin Dottie Roy and her marvelous writing and the vision she has for this world. And I can only hope that we can find the kind of vision in our hearts to have the kind of nation we really, I think, can have and need and deserve. So anyway, thanks for listening, and just keep it tuned to WMNF all day.
Priority, 'cause we're all-